Welcome back to MFA Writers. We're so happy to have you here. The pod team is also happy to be on spring break this week, enjoying some travel with family before finishing up the semester. So today we have a re-release of our wonderful debut author interview with Gina Cheung. Last year, Gina released her debut novel, Sea Change, which we talk about in this interview. But just a couple weeks ago today, Gina released her first story collection titled Green Frog. So please enjoy this interview, then go buy a copy of Green Frog, because I know you will enjoy that too. The pod will be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. In the meantime, you can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter, as well as MFAWriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms, or an email at MFAWritersPodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at MFAWriters.com. On that same website, you can also click the support button to support us financially, if it's within your means. Or you can do so by going directly to buymeacoffee.com/MFAWriters. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today we've got a special debut authors episode with Gina Cheung. Gina is a Korean-American writer from New Jersey, currently living in New York City. Her debut novel, Sea Change, was a 2023 Barnes & Noble Discover pick and a New York Times Most Anticipated book. Gina has also written a forthcoming short story collection titled Green Frog. A recipient of the Pushcart Prize, she is a 2021-2022 Center for Fiction Susan Camel Emerging Writer Fellow and holds an MFA in Fiction from the New School. Her work appears or is forthcoming in Kenyon Review, Literary Hub, Catapult, Electric Literature, Gulf Coast, Indiana Review, and Idaho Review, among others. Today, she's going to read us an excerpt from her novel, Sea Change.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Jared. So I'm just going to read to you all from the opening of my novel, Sea Change. This morning, Dolores is blue again. She's signaling her readiness to mate, her eagerness to mount the rocks and corals of her tank and push herself against a male octopus who will insert his hectocotylus into her mantle cavity and deposit sperm packets inside her until she is ready to lay the eggs. Unfortunately for Dolores, there is no bachelor octopus around ready to father her orphan eggs, and so when she turns that milky, almost pearlescent blue that I know means she is in the mood for love, there's no one but me to see. Dolores can turn herself as flat as a pancake or puff up like a mushroom, and when she propels herself through all 1,000 gallons of her tank, air bubbles dance around her like they're laughing with her. When she undulates her arms through the clean, dark water, she looks like a storm of ribbons. She can be cranky, like any old lady, but she loves seeing me come in with a bucket full of shrimp and fish for her. I could swear that sometimes she waves at me. So this morning, when I wished her good morning and told her how the weather was outside and she responded by turning blue, I didn't bat an eyelash. "You and me both, Lo," I said before turning the radio on and mopping up the floor. It was 8 a.m. and I wasn't about to empathize with a thirsty octopus over her sexual needs when I hadn't gotten laid in months. This is my own fault, I know. After Tay left, I basically coped with it by not coping at all. I've been broken up with before, but never because the guy in question was actually planning on leaving the planet. Tay never liked my working at the aquarium. He couldn't understand why I had tethered myself to a sinking ship, as he said. No pun intended, probably, knowing Tay. And it's true that we don't get too many visitors these days, especially with more and more of the animals being bought up by wealthy investors who want to be able to gawk at a giant endangered sea turtle in their at-home aquarium. The exhibit hall feels ghostly sometimes during the off-season, like an abandoned carnival ground. But Dolores is still here. She has been one of the aquarium's crown jewels since I was a kid, pressing my nose against the glass to marvel at her shimmering colors. She's probably one of the oldest giant Pacific octopuses in the world. Look at the size of her, Appa would say. Isn't she a beauty? He was a marine biologist and a consultant for the aquarium, tasked with making sure that the tanks replicated the animal's natural environments as much as possible. Alma always said, not really joking, that she wouldn't be surprised if he left her for Dolores someday. My manager, Carl, walks in, all hair cream and business. Dolores immediately turns inky dark and makes herself scarce. I don't blame her. Carl is the kind of guy who thinks everyone is happy to see him and always talks like he's wearing a headset. He's both fairly harmless and extremely irritating. Morning, ladies, he says, radiating caffeinated goodwill. Morning, Carl, I say, not looking up from my mopping. Carl pats the glass like it's a flank, and somewhere in the water I see one of Dolores' huge eyes open, a horizontal pupil flashing as she watches the movement of his fleshy pink hand, but Carl doesn't see her. Cheryl's out today, and Francine's got a field trip. Mind overseeing cleanup in tide pools, Ro? I open my mouth to tell him no, and he hastens to add, there might be a day off in it for you. I do it myself, but I can't stay late tonight. Hot date, I say, and then wish I hadn't, because the smile that spreads across Carl's face is the kind of smile that announces it's got something to say and it won't let you go till it's been said. Her name's Christina. Since it's our first date, I thought we'd, fine, just stop talking to me, please, I don't say. Days off used to mean something to me, back when Tay was still around and I had a life in which I did things outside of work. We used to plan weekend trips to towns we picked at random, either in upstate New York or down in South Jersey. Tay always took care of all the logistical details, but I was the one who planned out what hokey roadside attraction or niche museums we'd go see, like the wooden clog collection we found once in a town we breezed through on the way up to Hudson. Tay liked our jaunts, my propensity for seeking out the strange. I get to see more of the world with you, he told me once, after I'd forced him to go to a jug band concert played by animatronic squirrels somewhere outside Albany. But who says I can't take trips on my own, now that Tay's gone, somewhere in the Arizona desert? It's been months since I've had a break of any kind. Carl is surprised by my acquiescence. Super, he trills. See if you can get Dolores to come out and say hi later this afternoon when the field trip comes by. The kids always love her. As if in response, Dolores waves one pale arm through the water in his direction, which startles a yelp out of him. I suppress my laughter at the idea that anyone could get Dolores to do anything she doesn't want to do.
Tina, thank you so much. I'm sure you are a little bit exhausted at this point doing the whole publicity tour, so I really appreciate you coming by and chatting with me for a bit.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jared. I was so happy to be asked to come on the podcast. I'm a big fan, so a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm a big fan of yours as well, and I was very excited that you said yes. How can we not start with Dolores, the octopus that plays a starring role in your novel Sea Change, and who is illustrated beautifully, by the way, on the cover? I'm curious to hear when you first started thinking about this animal and where you got the inspiration for exploring it in this story.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd love to start with Dolores. She is just so fun to write about. And I started with this idea, and it's just the first line of the book, which is This Morning Dolores Was Blue. And it came from an in-class writing prompt in my MFA program, which was at the New School. And so I just started writing the first lines of what would become Sea Change during this class. And I had no idea who Dolores was, why she was turning blue, why this mattered. And so one thing I should also say is that I love writing about animals and the natural world. I find it like just really inspiring for me as a writer. And so I was like, who is Dolores? And then it kind of just popped into my head. I was like, oh, maybe she's an octopus. And I've always loved octopuses. I think that they're just so cool and fascinating. I've been a big fan of them even since before I started writing this novel. And so I thought, okay, she's turning colors. She's an octopus. And I kind of went from there and just kind of followed the voice, this first person voice that sort of came to me. And then from there, the world of the aquarium and the character of Ro herself sort of came to me in the writing of that. But yeah, it really did start with Dolores and just thinking about this sort of larger than life kind of fantastical octopus and what I could do in terms of playing around with that idea.
Do you remember what the prompt was?
It involved writing about something turning blue, and but it could be anything. It was a really open-ended prompt. Yeah, it was during a class I took at the New School with Wyatt Tu Moore, who's a fantastic speculative fiction writer, and she's also written nonfiction, but I think she's primarily known for her speculative fiction. And so we were exploring a lot of different modes of writing in the speculative register in that class. And so I think that's kind of also where the near future aspect of the story came from as well. It was inspired in part by that idea.
Yeah. Is that normally what your process is like, that you'll just kind of start writing and then something will jump out that you didn't expect and you just kind of try to figure it out from there? You mentioned trying to find the voice and just going from there. Is that pretty typical for you?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think I tend to typically start with voice. And that was definitely true for this project. And when it comes to just a general inspiration for writing, yeah, it often comes from like an image that I have or a question that I have, or like a hypothetical scenario will come to mind. I'll be like, oh, what if we were to change this around? Or what would it look like if we followed this particular person into this scenario? So I often start from a place of asking myself a lot of questions, and I find that that's the easiest way to keep myself interested in a project, is just to keep asking myself and figuring out those answers along the way.
Well, the more I read the book, the more I started to think about Dolores as kind of a point of comparison for human beings. I mean, throughout the story, we get this kind of exploration of the octopus and its many traits, like its amazing ability to change color and shape and size. And it got me thinking about our own unique traits as human beings. So to what extent were you looking at and thinking about the human characters in the story from an ecological perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when it comes to Dolores herself, so I learned a lot about octopuses while I was working on and researching the novel. And one of the really interesting things I learned about them was that they tend to be pretty solitary creatures. They only really meet up to like mate. And I don't know if you'll recall this from the book, but mating is sort of a very fraught process for octopuses. Like female octopuses, basically, once they mate and their eggs are fertilized, which is sort of like what the book sort of opens with, like, what if, you know, Dolores's eggs were to be fertilized? Like, they usually die as a result. They brood over the eggs. It's this weeks or months long process. And I also read somewhere that male octopuses also don't fare very well. They tend to just develop, I guess, a form of octopus dementia and just kind of die. And so it's this very like dramatic thing that happens with this otherwise very powerful and kind of intelligent species. So I found that really fascinating, especially the angle of like, you know, mother octopuses kind of brooding over their eggs. And it made me think a lot about sort of the motherhood and mother-daughter relationships that I was trying to explore in the process of the book. And I think Ro herself is a little bit, she's so drawn to creatures, and she works with them in her aquarium job. And in particular, she has a very special connection with Dolores. She's a little bit like Dolores herself in that she's quite secretive, likes to keep to herself. But of course, she's a human being. She has needs that a human being does have. And so I wanted throughout the course of the novel to sort of explore what would happen for this character who is similarly kind of solitary and secretive, to kind of come out of her shell and have to learn how to, you know, find her place among other human beings, no matter how difficult that might be. And I think humans are also, it's so easy for us to think of ourselves as being apart from or sort of like above the natural world or animals, but, you know, we are animals ourselves. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to writing about the natural world, because it just reminds me that we have our own place in there too.
Yeah. One of the things I really loved about this book was that exploration of the natural world and various animals, and like seeing what we could learn about ourselves by analyzing these different things. Like at one point in the book, the main character Ro talks about a Werner Herzog documentary she saw with her boyfriend titled Encounters at the End of the World, which is based in Antarctica. And in it, Herzog talks about penguins and how, unlike most animals, they tend to have only one partner for life, and that those that go off on their own have trouble surviving. There seems to be, to me, a parallel here, right? Like this need for connection could describe humans as well. So to what extent were you trying to explore this need for connection in human relationships in Sea Change through that, you know, exploration of nature?
Yeah, I would say that that's a really big theme in the book. And it was something I wanted to explore, certainly, when I set out to write the novel. I was very interested in this idea of like a kind of lonely, isolated character and, you know, thinking about how she got to be that way, but also how she could sort of grow and develop to the point where she realizes like, actually the strong thing to do is not just to be on my own trying to deal with everything by myself. It's to reach out to other people and try and be in community with others, even when that vulnerability is really scary. And yeah, that penguin scene. So that it is from a real documentary, which I highly recommend if anyone hasn't seen it. And I remember watching it a couple years ago and just feeling like similarly to Ro in that scene, just really moved by that penguin scene. And it's kind of funny slash cute, but also horrifying because, you know, they're very blunt about the fate of the penguin, which is that it's going to die without, you know, access to water and food and access to its community. And I think it's as human beings, like we are social animals and we need each other. And there's a reason we evolved to sort of crave that closeness and connection. And I think sometimes looking at, you know, the habits or the needs of animals, it's a refreshing reminder that like we as humans also have needs too, and that they need to be met.
Yeah. I mean, to me, one of the things the book is exploring is the relationships that we create and how those relationships can sometimes be really difficult, and how we decide like to persevere, which relationships to continue to have. I mean, in the book, Ro is 30 years old. She's just gone through a breakup. She's estranged from her mom. And there's this tension between her and her best friend at times. Like these are not easy relationships that she's dealing with in her life. So I don't know. Is it fair to say that the book is asking readers to consider why we struggle and persevere to maintain certain relationships, even when it's difficult?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think I wanted to certainly explore like what it looks like to feel like you've run aground a little bit when it feels like your closest relationships or what should be your closest relationships are no longer quite there in the same way. And I also, I wrote this, the bulk of the first like rough draft of this novel in fall, winter of 2020, which was like, you know, excruciatingly difficult time for everyone in the world.
Right,
but
right.
It was also a time when, you know, loneliness was such a big factor in so many people's lives. We were all isolated. And I also think a lot of people's relationships, many close relationships, mine included, were also kind of undergoing transformations during that time. Like there are some friendships that, you know, I like just to be like kind of frank, like there are friendships from that time that just like of mine that haven't really recovered from the fact that we all went into isolation and were slash still are deeply traumatized and moving through these moments of huge grief. And so those were definitely things that were on my mind at the time of writing. And while I don't know how intentional it was at the time, they made their way into the book in terms of thinking about what it looks like to sort of show up for yourself in these relationships, whether it means committing to them or just, you know, alternatively saying, well, I guess this relationship has served its time and maybe it's time for me to move on for my own sake. So, yeah. And I didn't want there to be any easy answers to that too in the book, because I mean, connection is so important and yet tenuous for so many of us. And for Ro in particular, I think connection is hard for her because of all the losses and the traumas that she's endured from, you know, from an early age. And when her boyfriend breaks up with her to go on this, you know, privately funded mission to colonize Mars, it kind of confirms for her this story that she's been telling herself from day one, which is that, oh, people leave me. I have to, you know, I'm always going to be abandoned. And I think when you are a person like that, or when you grow up telling yourself things like that, it's very easy to then start leaving yourself in all these smaller ways. And I was really interested in what that would look like from a storytelling perspective.
So once you figured out, so you talked about how when you first started writing the story, you weren't really sure what it was about. You were kind of figuring it out as you went. Once you kind of figured out that that was the core of the story, how do you proceed from there from a process standpoint? Are you going back and like rethinking everything you've written based on this idea that you've kind of found in the process? Or do you still try to foster like a sense of kind of exploration in the writing and still trying to figure it out as you go?
Yeah, I think it does tend to be more the latter for me. In terms of like strict like process logistics, I basically, once I figured out like, okay, here's the main character, here's the general broad strokes of the story, I did create like an outline, like chapter by chapter of like, you know, here's what will happen here. Here's where we'll go here. And that was important, especially for organizing the time structure of the book, since it's an alternating past present structure. But at the same time, I found that I kept deviating from the outline. And at first it was like stressing me out. And then I was like, well, it's my outline. And I think that's part of my process, honestly, is to just deviate and leave room for exploration. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't stay interested in a project if I had felt like I had already figured it all out. And so I knew that exploring loneliness and self-sabotage and the need for connection would be important to the story, but I didn't always know how it would manifest. And so it kept things interesting while I was working on the draft. And also when I did finally start showing it to readers, like to trusted readers, like it was always surprising and interesting, the things that they pointed out too, in terms of like, oh, here's where she's failing this person, or here's where this person has failed her. So I found that to be a really enlightening part of the writing process as well.
Yeah, I talk to a lot of writers who just like really swear by outlining and like really sticking to the outline. And so I'm curious about that for you, because I know that you've written a lot of short stories where it's a little easier to kind of hold on to that sense of exploration in like a smaller piece. But like when you're transitioning from writing short stories to writing a much longer piece like a novel, how do you balance that? That need for the outline, so you have some general direction for this huge project, but also maintaining that sense of exploration.
And this was also my first attempt at writing a novel. So like, I felt like I had no idea what I was doing. Still don't really know what I'm doing mostly. And I also firmly believe that like, you know, every creative writing project like kind of teaches you how to write it. So like, I might have an idea for like, you know, how to go about the next thing, but it might totally change along the way. I am finding that to be true with working on the beginnings of my next novel as well, where I'm like, oh yeah, this process isn't going to work this time around, because it's an entirely different story. In terms of balancing it, I guess what helped was to look at each chapter as sort of like not a discrete story, because you know they're all connected, but they were elucidating different incidents in the character's life. And so it helps to approach it that way, especially because when I first started, I was really daunted by the length of it, where I would like write a chapter, like I would draft a chapter and then be like, wow, I can't believe I just did that. And then be like, oh wait, I have to do that again and again and again, like at least 10 or 15 more, you know, for however long. And it can always change too, but I found the easiest thing was to just try and push through it as much as I could. And this is, you know, it's easier said than done, of course, as any writer knows. But it's, I think when you do get into a flow with a larger project, that is a luxury that you don't always get to experience with a short story sometimes. And that like, you just start to like, you eventually start to immerse yourself in the world that you've created. I think it can happen with short stories, but with a novel, you just spend so much more time with it. So that becomes like a real like luxurious sense of play, which I found to be so exciting. And like, it was something I didn't know could happen. I was like, I was expecting it to be all kind of like, you know, not agony, but I thought I was expecting it to be pretty difficult. And then I was like, oh wait, I had no idea I could have so much fun while writing my own novel, which is like such a silly thing to have discovered. But it was a very heartening discovery too, to find that I was enjoying the world that I was creating bit by bit.
We have a lot of process conversations on this podcast, because I think as writers, we all like wish that there was just like a process that we could figure out and then repeat, right? But in my experience, it's like every time I write a short story that works, I'm like, yes, I figured it out. And I start writing the next story and I'm like, that process does not work for this story. Yeah. So we're like constantly talking about it, like trying to figure it out. But in the end, it just is changing all the time, I feel like. And we have to be open to that change and allow ourselves to like rediscover how to write a story, I think.
Totally. Yeah. And I think like too, with fiction in particular, because you're writing about people that you invented, but you know, that have their roots in like your own psyche, it also always helps to think about, I mean, I like to think of them as like, you know, entities that exist in the world, even though they don't. And so it's always like, I like to think of it from a perspective of like, okay, if I'm stuck on this, like, what does this character need? Like, what do I not know about them yet? And like, so that's kind of how I've tended to approach it. So I guess that is one sort of like consistent thing that I've tried to do in my process. And with this next novel that I'm starting to write and feeling, you know, like I don't fully yet know how the world is going to end up. Like, I feel like I need to do some like character work. Maybe it feels like weird method acting kind of, but for me, that's what tends to work best.
Well, there was one other thing that stood out to me thematically about the book, and that I thought it took a really interesting look at climate change and our relationship as human beings to our environment. So like Rose father describes at one point how every animal, even the most seemingly inconsequential, has an important role to play in the ecosystem. And yet in real life, like almost daily, we're faced with like news of species on the brink of extinction. In the book, Rose's boyfriend leaves her to go on this mission to Mars, at least partially because he thinks it might be the only solution to climate change here on Earth. In real life, this is an idea that is already being explored, right? So yep. What do you hope readers will take away from the book in relation to climate, the environment, and our effect on it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that cli-fi as a term is like, you know, it used to be sort of, from my perspective at least, it used to be this sort of like sub-genre within speculative fiction. But increasingly, I feel like as writers, like there's just much more of that type of literature coming out into the world. And I think it's because we're living it, right? Like,
right.
You know, I wrote what I think is sort of a speculative fiction near future type of book, but it's, you know, nothing that's in the book is something that I don't think could happen at some point, you know, including the Mars stuff, which is, you know, people are literally planning that and like investing in it as we right. speak. And I'm sure right. it will happen. And I guess my main thing that I wanted readers to take away from reading the book was just this understanding of like how interdependent and how fragile our ecosystems are. I mean, I don't think that anyone who is going to read this book anyway would disagree with that, I would say. Like, it's probably preaching to the choir a little bit. But for me, I find that maintaining a sense of hope in the face of like the very understandable despair of our times is super important. And so I think that like, hopefully this book, while it doesn't have, of course, answers to the problem of what to do in the face of what's going on, I hope it gives people a sense of hope in that, like, you know, I mean, when I think about animals in the natural world, one of the main things that strikes me is like, one, how fragile it all is, and, you know, how sad and scary it is that like species are vanishing every day as we speak. But another thing that it leaves me with is a hope for resilience and the fact that like so many of these creatures and these plants and these ecosystems have been operating this way since well before we came along. And of course, they're experiencing the impact that humans have made on them. But, you know, I do think that like, no matter what happens, like life will continue. And I hope that we're able to take action before it's too late. It might already be too late in some ways, but the pessimist in me is very like, it can be a very loud voice, but I also want to give space for hope because it's like, we have to hope for a better future in order to work towards it. And so I guess that's something I wanted to leave readers with because it's just something I struggle with myself.
Yeah. Well, I think you do a great job of like not trying to prescribe some easy answer to these issues, right? Like a lot of this stuff, there's nuance there. It's open. Like for example, Ro loves Dolores, the octopus, but then she also dreams of the octopus escaping into the open ocean, which to me seems to be arguing for some kind of balance between our want and need for knowledge and, you know, having respect for nature.
Yeah, I think that as an aquarist, like Ro does feel that tension between wanting to, you know, her father was a scientist and he passed on this sort of curiosity about the natural world to her. So she really wants to sort of learn from these creatures as much as we can. But she also very much understands that, you know, ideally Dolores could be free. And so I think that like, yeah, I didn't want the book to necessarily provide like a solution or an answer to that, but I did want readers to have a sense of like understanding of like, okay, here's where this character is coming from and here's how we might be able to find solace and hope in the face of seemingly hopeless circumstances.
Well, like I said, it's a really beautiful book, one that I really enjoyed reading. And I've actually been reading a lot of your writing over the years, especially your short stories that you've published, and I really love them too.
Oh, thank you.
And as you know, a lot of our listeners are emerging writers and MFA students. And they might be wondering why it is that so many writers get started writing short stories but tend to publish a novel before they publish their collection. I'm guessing it has something to do with the publishing industry, but I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. I think, in terms of why most of us start with short stories, which was definitely the case for me, I think it's because, honestly, the modern MFA format sort of lends itself more, I think, to workshopping short stories. Like, I've actually never workshopped parts of this novel with like a larger group. The only time I did was when I thought it was just going to be a short story. And everyone in that group was like, I think it should be a novel because you have lots of unanswered questions here. And I was like, cool, thanks for the note. And now I have to go write this novel, I guess. But I think you can workshop a novel. I think it's probably challenging though, because, you know, most likely people are not getting to see the full thing. And in terms of why I think a lot of people tend to come out with a novel first is it is a marketability thing, I think, to a certain degree. I used to work in the publishing industry myself. And while I didn't work necessarily in the realm of like fiction and literary fiction, it was a really interesting education in sort of like the business of books, right? Which is a very, very different process than the process of writing a book. And I think it's one that a lot of writers don't know very much about. And, I think it's really important for us to like arm ourselves with this information as much as we can before we go into this process. And it also helps to, I think, learn how to see your book as like a thing that's moving in the world that's independent of your labor and your love on it. Like that, those are two very different processes. I think it's really good for any emerging writer to be aware of that fact. I think for novels, from what I understand, it's easier to market like a one story that has like, you know, it can have more than one arc, of course, but like usually a novel tends to have one arc, and that tends to be an easier thing for a publishing team to sort of get out there, especially for a debut author. And I mean, I love short story collections. I think they're amazing. And I'm so happy to be able to put one out as well. And I think that we need more of them as well. But I think that's, to my understanding, why novels tend to come out before short story collections, if the writer does have a novel. So that's my very, very general and maybe vague and unhelpful understanding of why that is.
Well, okay. So having written short stories, published short stories, you having worked in the publishing industry, what did you learn from those experiences that you think helped you in the process of both writing and trying to get your novel published?
Yeah, I'll start with your question about working in the publishing industry first. So that was when I worked in publishing. Those were some of my like first like kind of official adult jobs coming out of college. And I started out working in publicity at an adult commercial nonfiction imprint at Penguin. This was before the merger with Random House. This was like many years ago. And working in publicity and marketing actually taught me so much about the process of how a book even makes its way out into the world. Like once the editorial on it is done, once the production on it is done, like there's a whole long behind the scenes process that your publicist and your marketer will go through to, you know, working with the author, working with the editor, of course, to sort of place it in the right, what they feel are the right sort of markets for that book. And so that process taught me a lot about, you know, the importance of the writer's own contacts. Like no matter what contacts you might have, or even if you feel like you're not super connected, like you probably have more connections than you think you do. And so it's really important for, I think, writers going into that process to be aware and to not be shy about asking your community to sort of like support you, whether it's by pre-ordering or, you know, accepting review requests if they're interested in interviewing you or running a review of the book. So those are all super important to the process of getting a book out into the world. And it also gave me so much respect for the many amazing people who work in publishing. Like, it's not an easy industry. It's one filled with a lot of upheavals, as we've all seen in recent years. And so, like, your publishing team is usually overworked. And there are people who have just as much of a stake as you in getting your book out there. At the same time, I think it's also important for authors to remember that they are the best sort of representative that the book can have, because you know the book best out of everyone else in the world. So those are just like important expectations, I think, to have going into the process. And let's see. I will say, however, that being in publishing for the years that I was, It wasn't necessarily helpful for me personally as a writer. I know that there are some people who can do both, like work in the publishing industry in a given capacity and work on their own creative writing. And that's amazing. But for me, I found it kind of daunting. You know, I guess when you're faced with like, when you're coming face to face with like finished products on a day-to-day basis, it kind of makes you feel like, oh no, my own writing, it will never get to this stage. So I actually felt like I needed to step away from the industry in order to like actually focus on my writing. So I was taking kind of writing classes here and there whenever I could. And then it wasn't until a couple years later when I decided to take the plunge and apply for MFA programs. And then in terms of writing short stories, I think it teaches you a lot as a fiction writer to work on these like shorter stories in terms of thinking about like character and beats. As a writer, I struggle the most with like plot. And so with short stories, you have an opportunity because you're working in generally like a much smaller canvas to think about like action and reaction and sort of like how you're going to structure a story so that the character can arrive at a different place than maybe where you started. And so I found that to be really helpful. And I think also the process of working on short stories and getting feedback on them, you know, I have all kinds of thoughts about the traditional workshop model and how it does and doesn't work. But I think one thing that is really helpful for a beginning writer working on short stories is that getting feedback is not always like, it's not that the feedback is always going to be the magic bullet that your story needs, but it does teach you after a couple of rounds of this to sort of filter the feedback that is helpful to you and filter out the feedback that is not as helpful to you. So every editing process I've gone through with a short story, whether it was with like an editor at a publication or just with like friends who are offering comments on it, that's helped me so much more to learn to learn how to accept the feedback that I think is going to be really helpful, but also learn how to like learn when to listen to my own writing voice and say like, oh, actually, I think I don't necessarily want to do this. So yeah, those are sort of like the main kind of takeaways that I got from those experiences. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned at a certain point deciding to take the plunge into applying to MFA programs. What motivated that decision to go that route? And how was that experience? And how do you feel that experience helped you in your development as a writer?
The thing that motivated me to go through with it was I was like kind of having one of several quarter life crises and just felt, you know, that moment in your 20s when you were just like, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, my life is not where I want it to be right now. And so it was mostly personal things. But then one thing I knew for sure was that, you know, I love writing and I want to find a way to keep on doing this. And for me, I was like, I think I've gotten as good as I can get, you know, doing what I've been doing on my own, which is, again, sort of taking classes haphazardly on my own whenever I could. Occasionally exchanging writing with people. And I knew that going into an MFA, I hoped that going into an MFA program would give me structure and the time to work on my writing and also access to a writing community. And so going into an MFA program, like that was the first time I was able to access those things. And it was really transformational for me. I don't think, of course, that everyone who wants to be a writer has to go into an MFA. Like, sure. It's not right for everyone, nor is it necessary for everyone. But for me, it was what I felt I really needed.
So do you have any advice for listeners who are considering that route, going to the MFA? Any advice for getting the most out of that experience?
Definitely. I think that, it sounds basic to say, but definitely doing your research on all of the programs you're applying to is the best, most fundamental thing that you can do. And also making sure that the faculty you want to work with at any given program will be there, hopefully, by the time that you enroll in the program. And like, it's not always predictable because sometimes faculty go on leaves, that sometimes they have to go on book tour. But, you know, it's always helpful to ask around and whenever you can try and talk to like a current student in the MFA program or someone who's graduated recently just to get their take on that experience. And I would also say, you know, I think there's a lot of discussion in the community of people who are applying or have applied to MFA programs about like fully funded programs versus partially funded. I don't think anyone, I'll be very clear and say, I don't think anyone should go into debt for an MFA program. Ideally, no one would go into debt for education period, but you know, we live where we live. And at the same time, I think fully funded programs, they're obviously the most competitive to get into. And so I didn't get into any of the fully funded programs I applied to, and I ended up deciding to go to the program that I did because I was able to get some partial funding that with the day job that I was going to work at the same time, I knew I could make it work financially. Had it not been the case for that funding, I don't think I would have made the decision to go. I would probably have tried to reapply or, you know, maybe taken a step back. So I think that those are two very important things for people to keep in mind. And also reapply, you know, if you don't get into the schools that you want to, or you don't have as much success in your initial round, like people reapply all the time. And I've heard from various friends and people in my writing community that you often can get like a much better result after reapplying, especially because at that point you'll have known the process better. Maybe you have more writing to add to your portfolio. So don't get discouraged, ask around for help, do your research, and don't be afraid to reapply.
What about the post-MFA life? So after you graduated from that program, how was that transition for you? Were there any unexpected challenges you faced in your writing life?
Yeah, I think, it's an interesting question because I think my answer would have been different had it not been for the fact that I graduated in 2021. And so when I started my MFA program, it was fall 2019. And we had about a semester and a half of like in-person classes and events and activities before everything went virtual because of the pandemic. And I feel like I got really lucky with the amazing friends and writers that I was able to meet in that program, who I'm still friends with and still writing with to this day and hope to do so for the rest of my writing life, as well as with the faculty that I got to work with. So I think when I did graduate from the program, it felt a little bit anticlimactic because I was like, oh, well, we've just been on Zoom the entire time. And I also knew that like all the people that I loved from the program, I would continue, you know, writing with and hanging out with in my life outside of the program. One thing I did run into was like just this fear of like, oh gosh, like, have I wasted all this time? Am I, you know, how am I going to like get back that structure that I really needed? Am I going to be able to like produce the same amount of writing that I was doing before? And one thing that really helped, I think, was forming my own writing groups outside of the program with friends that I'd made. And also just reminding myself that the writing is going to take as long as it needs to take. And that, you know, the program ultimately gave me the jumpstart that I needed. I think just reminding myself of those things like really helped ease the anxiety that I felt like leaving it. I think also leaving with like, you know, a goal or more than one goal in mind helps too with that transition. It doesn't have to be like, I'm going to sell this book within the next 6 months or whatever. Like it can be as ambitious as that, but it can be something like I will finish the draft of my thesis, which is going to be my novel, or it could be like, I'm going to submit to like 30 more journals than I did last year. So I think it always helps to like give ourselves goals like that, because as we all know, once you leave school, it's like you have to like make the structure that that school provided for you once you leave.
So I want to talk a little bit more about community, which you've mentioned a couple times now. I know you're close friends with a couple of our past guests, Jemima Way and Vanessa Chan. A lot of people go to creative writing programs hoping to establish relationships with other writers. How important has it been to you and your writing development to have friends like that who are also emerging writers with similar goals?
Oh my gosh, it's everything. It's so important for me personally. And I know it's not necessarily everyone's priority or prerogative, but you mentioned Jemima and Vanessa, two of my closest friends and two of like my most trusted readers when it comes to new writing. I have so many amazing friends, truly, that I've made both in my MFA program and actually just in the writing community in New York City. Like, a lot of people rag on New York City. It's very expensive to be here and can be quite disruptive. But one of the main, like, sort of boons of being in New York City is that, like, you know, there are writers everywhere, and there's like all kinds of ways of forming writing community even outside of the structure of an MFA program. And so that's just been so wonderful. And I think it's really vital to like, not just for like, you know, getting feedback on your writing from people whose work you trust. It's also really important for just teaching ourselves about the industry. I think the other thing that being in New York allows you access to is just the world of publishing, right? Whether it's events or readings or like big gala events that happen, like there's always something going on, especially here in New York, especially now that things have, you know, been opening up again. So I think it's always helpful to like be able to navigate that landscape, which can be really fun and really exciting, but also can be a little overwhelming with like a core group of friends. And with my group of writing friends in particular, we're also like, I think we all sort of believe in the value of like information sharing, and like, we don't want to be gatekeepers. And I think it's so helpful to be like, hey, here's this like journal that's like, you know, accepting submissions, or this contest, or here's this agent that I met who might be interested in your work. Like, I think like having that has just been so, so valuable for me. And it also helps because, you know, then you feel a little bit less like insane sometimes as a writer, where you can be like, can you look at this? Like, am I like, is this piece like, you know, just does it need more work? Or, you know, can you tell me more about this writing opportunity? Like, it's so helpful to have people that you can reach out to in a trusted, close community like that. So yeah, my writing friends, who are also like just IRL friends, they're everything for me, and so helpful in my development as a writer and just as a human being.
Well, before we go, I have one more question I want to ask. This season on the podcast, we've been asking our guests, who are mostly current MFA students, to tell us one way in which the MFA experience has been different, for better or for worse, from their expectations when applying. So I want to ask you a slightly different version of this, which is, what is one way in which the publishing experience has been different, for better or for worse, from your expectations when you first started submitting?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that I wasn't quite expecting going into the publication process, which is funny because, like, you know, as I mentioned, I worked in book publishing, so you think I know this, but there's a lot of homework to being a writer. And I'm not even just talking about the editing process, which can take anywhere from like a few months to, in some people's cases, like over the course of years, potentially. There's just a lot that you have to do in terms of administrative work, like, you know, whether it's assembling contacts to send out galleys to, or coming up with ideas for your marketing publicity team in terms of like essays you could write for placement, or, you know, Instagram people that you want to reach out to. Like, there's a lot of like just admin work that goes into this process of bringing a book out into the world. And so I think that's why I said earlier, it's really helpful for writers to have a clearer understanding of the business of books. And I think it's also so helpful to sort of divorce yourself from the idea of like yourself as like a writer, which is like, for me, my writing brain tends to be very like creative, kind of messy, a little bit all over the place. And that's like a place that's generative for me. It's not helpful to be coming from that place when you're trying to like schedule things for yourself, right? Or like ask emails and, you know, or send emails asking questions and like adhere to deadlines. And so there's just been a lot of like legwork, more legwork than I anticipated going into that process. But also, I think it's so important also to know that you can ask for help, whether it's from your agent, whether it's from writing friends, if you want them to take a look at an email you're sending, and also to ask for leeway around deadlines if you need it, because like the publication process is a long one. And there are a lot of interim deadlines in between. But if like you're in a situation where, you know, everything's kind of coming at you at once, and you don't think you can get to something on time, like you can ask for that flexibility. You can ask for that deadline, like to be moved. Like, more than likely your team is going to want to meet you more than halfway on this. And so that's been a big like learning curve for me during this process. So yeah, there's a lot of homework to being a writer. Who knew? But it's fun. It's all fun, you know, in the name of like getting your book out into the world. Right. So that's something that I love to remind myself of too, is just like, oh my gosh, how lucky am I that I'm like, I get to be doing all this stuff towards the process of my book making its way to people into the world.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to stop in and talk about your debut novel, Sea Change, which I hope all of our listeners will go out and buy from their local independent bookstore if possible.
Thank you so much, Jared. This was so fun. Really had a great time being here talking with you.
Thank you.